Welcome to this month's episode of Don't Miss a Beat. I'm Dr. Stephen Green, a heart failure cardiologist, and I'm here with my good friend and partner in crime, Dr. Muthu Vadugunathan. And we are also here with Dr. Kathy Tuttle, who is a professor and executive director of the University of Washington and a leading clinical trialist in pretty much all things kidney. That's really underselling it. But we are here at the Heart and Diabetes Meeting. This is the 10th annual Heart and Diabetes Meeting in Philadelphia. And, you know, humbly, I am honored to be one of the co-chairs of the meeting here. And it's been a great meeting so far. Lots of cutting edge science, but also trying to keep things very, very practical for the treating clinician. But among the key topics that we are discussing heart and diabetes is the latest data with finerenone, including FIND-CKD, and some of the emerging data. We just got over the FIND-1 results. Now we have FIND-CKD. And, you know, who better to help us, you know, understand the context for FIND-CKD and the results than Dr. Tuttle. So really honored to have you here today.
Oh, thank you. And really an exciting time. I mean, we've been waiting for these wins for decades, right? And we now have trial data showing that finerenone is highly efficacious and safe for non-diabetes-related forms of chronic kidney disease, really across the board. So the FIND-CKD was designed similar to our Figaro and Fidelio trials. People had to have at least 200 milligram per gram of UACR or albuminuria and a GFR of 25, as high as 90. They were enrolled in a randomized controlled trial, irrespective of diagnosis. There were nearly 900 people who had forms of glomerular disease, even. And what we found is, irrespective of diagnosis, that finerenone compared to placebo significantly slowed loss of kidney function, which we measured by GFR slope, which was the primary outcome, by 0.7 mL per minute per 1.73 meter squared per year. And why that's important is, we know from an abundance of trial evidence that if a trial goes at least 2 years and we see a slope difference of that magnitude, it's highly predictive of benefit on the true outcome of kidney failure or 50% GFR decline or death related to kidney or CV causes. And then that was the main secondary outcome, was combined kidney and cardiovascular outcome, which, by the way, in addition included heart failure admissions. And that was reduced I think the hazard ratio was 0.73, close to 30%. So that was the main secondary outcome. So another win, very consistent with what we saw in the diabetes studies. So I'll stop there in case you want to have any reflections on that.
And congratulations to the FIND-CKD investigators. This is a landmark trial and is poised to inform regulatory decision-making, which I believe is under review at the present time, to expand the label for finerenone to all forms of CKD. And so I'm curious about that primary endpoint. You said it was the change in GFR and the follow-up periods about 32 months here. A lot of our audience are broader than the nephrology world. And so tell us a little bit about the clinical meaningfulness of a change in GFR of that magnitude of 0.7.
Sure. Well, and just sort of back to some fundamental principles, I think most people would accept that loss of kidney function is on the pathway to kidney failure. And one of the challenges in doing clinical trials is the time required for getting to that, quote, endpoint, you know, as opposed to typical cardiovascular trials where the endpoints are discrete events, a myocardial infarction, a stroke, a heart failure admission. This is progression of disease. And so it's on a different timeline. And that's where we've struggled, in the sense that it can take many more years to hit kidney failure, true failure of the organ giving up its last gasp. So there has been a lot of work to try to understand what would be clinically meaningful outcomes that could be done within a feasible period of time. So there's a huge amount of work that's been done from a group called the CKD Prognosis Consortium, where they have analyzed many trials, hundreds of thousands of patients. And this is a very reliable indicator that if the trial will go at least 2 years, it will predict the outcome. And then again, even though this trial was relatively short and the clinical outcomes were secondary, even the a kidney outcome alone, which was also a secondary outcome. So even taking the CV death and a heart failure events out, there was still a benefit of about the same magnitude, about a 30% reduction. So we've had to move to outcomes that we can measure and that are feasible within the time course of a trial. And I think this is a nuance that people fail to appreciate. It's not an acute event. It's progression of disease, which is a much more difficult outcome to achieve, again, within the constraints of clinical trials.
And I think, you know, in this case, when the top line results were announced, you know, we had the primary endpoint, we're like, okay, it's going to be positive. But I think, you know, a lot of us, we're going to be keen on the secondary endpoints because it kind of validates this reliable, clinically meaningful. And I think you kind of nicely walk through the kidney CV composite was statistically significantly reduced. Yeah. And, you know, kind of goes with this being eGFR slope of 0.7 being a meaningful improvement there.
Right. And actually, we were very, I guess, gratified to see that the difference in slope and actually the hazard ratio and the number of events, the absolute number of events, came in almost exactly as we had projected when we did the statistical analysis plan, which really sort of also reassured us that we were thinking right about the trial design in this case. The other thing, too, and you may be facing some of this in cardiology, as we continue to sort of ratchet down residual risk, we're going to have fewer outcomes in trials, but yet there is still residual risk. So, you know, what are meaningful outcomes that we can measure that don't require somebody to die or have a heart attack, right?
Right.
So I think this is an evolution of trials. So it's actually really creative and exciting, too. I mean, I enjoy that part of it as well.
I mean, you talked at a high level about the safety.
Yeah,
but I think this is always something, you know, top of mind. You know, we've learned in cardiology, and you know, for maybe overblown the concerns over hyperkalemia and hesitancy it introduces. But now with finerenone, we've seen some of the hyperkalemia signals in the prior studies, although they seem not no head to head with steroidal MRA, but it seemed potentially more modest. But what did you guys see with hyperkalemia in FIND-CKD?
Well, first of all, there were very few discontinuations due to hyperkalemia. There were more hyperkalemia adverse events. It was, I think, about 12% versus 3%. But very few people, like less than 1%, had to come off the drug. So it was manageable. So I think the important thing is pay attention. This is a known side effect of drugs that inhibit the renin angiotensin system. And when you give two of them, like an MRA along with an ACE or an ARB, we do it in nephrology, you do it in heart failure, you just have to pay attention, and it can be managed. There is a higher rate of hyperkalemia, but I think we've learned to stay on top of it. So most people can safely take the drug. How much hyperkalemia can we tolerate? I mean, again, this is now more clinical practice, but I think this is important for your audience. I mean, in a CKD population, we may be a little more tolerant. Maybe we have a little more comfort with it. But, you know, up to about 5.5, we're going to go ahead and continue those drugs. If it gets above that, we're going to try to manage it. This was not part of our trial, but I think this is an important nuance as we move toward combination therapies, that SGLT2 inhibitors, which we're also going to commonly use with CKD and heart failure, reduce the risk of hyperkalemia by, depending on the analysis you want to look at, but somewhere in the range of 20% to 25%. So especially if you have an SGLT2 inhibitor on board, this will really help to mitigate risk of hyperkalemia. But I want to be clear, that wasn't part of FIND-CKD, but it's a practical matter that I think is important when people are thinking about now what are they going to do when they go home to treat patients.
And it was nice to see that the effects of finerenone on the kidney and cardiovascular risks were consistent irrespective of background use of SGLT2 inhibitors in FIND-CKD. So I'm curious that you had mentioned this intriguing 900 or so people with a specific form of glomerulonephritis or a specific form of GN, including IgA nephropathy or FSGS. And this is a group that's very, very exciting because of a lot of emerging targeted disease-modifying therapies that have very specific pathway modification. So how does a broader therapy like finerenone that might be considered foundational for many patients with CKD fit in now with these more targeted forms of therapy that might be used in specific GN populations?
So that's a great question, and it's very heartening, no pun intended, to have a cardiologist ask me about glomerular disease. We have come a long way. We are truly in a therapeutic renaissance in the field of nephrology. And it turns out that the glomerular diseases have become very targetable now. The specific therapies really target the inciting factors. Most of these are immunologic diseases. So in the case of IgA nephropathy, we have these amazing new therapies that target B-cell maturation, memory B cells that are specifically activated in Peyer's patches in the gut and produce this abnormal IgA that circulates and gets trapped in the kidney and activates complement. So it's really a four-hit, for example, hypothesis. And the way we got to the treatments is understanding the biology. If we don't control the inciting immunologic disease, we will still have progression. So those folks now should be treated with true disease-modifying therapies. Where does finerenone fit in? And other drugs that treat general CKD. This would also include SGLT2 inhibition. It would also include conventional renin angiotensin system inhibition. Well, it turns out that once disease is activated, whether it's by an immunologic and inflammatory disease, a hemodynamic disease like diabetes, a metabolic disease, which diabetes also is, there are final common pathways of target organ injury, and they end up in feed-forward cycles, particularly of inflammation and fibrosis. So those other general CKD treatments dial into the final common pathways. And you really need both, because we also know from immunologic kidney diseases that if we don't treat the final common pathways, even if we treat the GN, they still progress. There's a point of no return. So now we've really moved to combination therapies which treat the inciting disease and the progression factors, I guess, which would be the non-nephrology way to think about this. But it's really fundamentally important, and it comes from understanding the biology. And you guys may want to talk about this a little bit, but I think you're starting to move in that direction when you think about heart failures, because there's always a reason the heart fails. I mean, it's not natural aging, right? Like, something started that. But we've used very sort of generic therapies that deal with progressive loss of organ function. And so, you know, I'm glad to be here, because like, some of these conditions that were so vexing and so debilitating and deadly are now becoming treatable. I mean, but it really comes from fundamentally understanding the biology too, which I think is so exciting. True translational medicine.
I think you guys have the advantage, though, you know, over cardiology, I think, and then you have the tissue biopsies.
Yeah.
And like, you know, although we talk about etiology of heart failure, I think, you know, outside of, you know, things like ATTR cardiomyopathy and very specific granular things, and even ischemic cardiomyopathy, a lot of debate over what does that mean?
Yeah.
You know, what degree of CAD is the, you know, causal versus not just a bystander. So, I mean, it's super interesting to think about, yeah, the treating the inciting factor within that common pathway type of therapies. Now, thinking of like the common therapies, like these common pathway therapies, you know, back to heart failure analogy, you know, we learned the hard way that HFrEF is not HFpEF,
right,
in a sense of response to certain therapies.
Yep.
But now, you know, you guys in nephrology, you know, have, you know, on traditionally thought about, you know, diabetic CKD and non-diabetic CKD. And, you know, yes, some trials have mixed them together, you know, like thinking of DAPA-CKD as one of the first big trials that mixed them together. But even still, in contemporary times, obviously, to find CKD, we have to separate them out. Do you think that's the path forward anymore for these?
No,
common,
we aren't going to do it anymore. And part of the reason, again, comes back to understanding mechanisms. So there have been a number of studies now, one of which, you know, I've been involved with as one of the investigators now for 8 years, which is the Kidney Precision Medicine Project. And this project really was squarely focused on obtaining tissue and deep phenotyping to begin, when we started, really to begin to understand the biology in a way we had never before understood. And so it includes people with common forms of CKD who have biopsies who wouldn't normally have kidney biopsies. So in the diabetes cohort, only half of them have good old-fashioned diabetic nephropathy, and these are protocol biopsies. These are not people who had some weird form of kidney disease, so their clinicians decided to do a biopsy. A About a quarter have diabetic nephropathy mixed with another disease like IgA. And then a lot of immunologic disease, really a lot. And then a quarter just have something else altogether. And then it's not just KPMP, other groups like BeAT-DKD in Europe, and then even a study that I'm involved with called REMODEL, which was basically the mechanistic companion study to FLOW, was a deep phenotyping study, including kidney biopsies, where that exact same distribution of diagnoses has been reproduced. So first off, when we did DKD studies, we weren't studying diabetic nephropathy. Well, maybe in half the people we were, but in half we were studying another disease altogether or a mix, but it made no difference. The outcomes were the same because these treatments to date in diabetes have really focused on final common pathways. But this blows the door open for precision medicine now. So we have population level studies, and now we have precision studies. And REMODEL, which has been presented and hopefully will soon be published, has given us a lot of insights, not only into what disease people have, but how a disease is modified by therapy, in that case, semaglutide.
This is very, very exciting. I want to sort of, as we wrap up, the ending of that ERA session, which was really, really brilliant and took us through the wealth of data that was coming out, you ended with a sort of banner statement of protecting kidneys, hearts, and lives. And you framed the FIND-CKD data alongside what we now understand as sort of pillars of care for CKD. So for, and if you could take us through this, for diabetic and non-diabetic CKD, where do we see the treatment paradigms now evolved? You have four pillars for diabetic CKD. Does this change now for non-diabetic CKD?
Yes, I think it does. I mean, I think we certainly have the ACE-ARBs, SGLT2s, now we add finerenone, and I think we're just waiting for the GLP-1 studies, to be honest with you. And then, of course, there's also the endothelin A receptor antagonists, which are also showing benefit across the board, because endothelin is another one of those final common pathway targets. So I think, very similar to the heart failure field, we have these pillars, but I do think that the future is then now getting to where we can phenotype people more precisely, because maybe not everyone needs everything. And we do have to get to a point of facing the reality that that's going to be a big lift for the millions of people. And there may be some low-risk patients who need one drug. Maybe there are people who need everything or something else. And I view our field, and maybe I'd be interested in your perspective about heart failure, maybe starting to look more like clinical oncology with deeper phenotyping. Because when I was a young doctor, everybody with breast cancer got the same four drugs, Cytoxan, methotrexate, 5-FU, and prednisone. And the outcomes were horrible. We overtreated some people and gave them terrible toxicities. Other people, it wasn't the right treatment. It was too much. And they died. Now, if we look over the last 30 years, breast cancer mortality down 50%. But we deeply phenotype people with biomarkers, imaging, tissue. And you can go everything from low-risk lumpectomy, have a nice life, to stem cell transplant and investigational therapy, and about 15 or more pathways in between. But they had to have therapies to get to precision. And that's what really took the mortality down. And then back to saving kidneys, hearts, and lives, I think this is important for a cardiology audience. We also presented the Infinity meta-analysis, which was Fidelio, Figaro, the two diabetes studies, and then FIND meta-analyzed together, much like your meta-analysis with FIND Heart. And across the board, for all the kidney outcomes, including, let's just cut to the chase, kidney failure, all the cardiovascular outcomes, heart failure admissions, cardiovascular death, and all-cause mortality, all significantly reduced. For all-cause mortality, it was about 11%. Kidney outcomes, about 30%. Cardiovascular outcomes, about 30%. So that's why I said at the end, save kidneys, hearts, and lives, because this is a group of patients who are very high risk for both outcomes. And to be honest with you, it's the same person, right? So it's the door they walk in through. If they walk into my clinic, I say they're a CKD a person with CKD who has heart failure. You might see that person as a heart failure, someone with heart failure who has CKD. But, you know, in broad strokes, many of our patients are the same people. So we need to look at the totality of risks.
I think one of the convenient things, because we're always talking about implementation and the gaps.
Yeah. Right? Yes.
One of the convenient things with this whole CKM paradigm we're in is that the therapy that's good for one of the CKM conditions is often good for the other. What's good for prevention, like I was just giving a talk last night about heart failure and talking about heart failure prevention and then treatment of HFpEF. Well, the good news is, because people are asking questions, well, when does pre-heart failure end and HFpEF start? Well, maybe it doesn't really matter that much because the therapies that are good for the prevention are oftentimes good for the treatment these days. So it's really an exciting time that we're in right now.
It is. It is. And the other thing, too, is that people stay alive and they stay more functional. You know, we aren't talking about prolonging life in people who, you know, are unable to live fully. I mean, these are people whose hearts work, their kidneys work. You know, I'll just say of my own practice, people stay in the workforce. They contribute. So, you know, that's the question we get asked, too. Well, you know, are you trying to make people live forever? Well, if they can live well and live long, I think that's a win. Yeah.
Fantastic. First of all, congratulations, Steve, on Heart and Diabetes. This has been an impressive, impressive meeting already, and we're just in the middle of it. And Kathy, thank you once again. You're an inspiration to all of us from the cardiology side, and we are trying to mirror our efforts in clinical trials and practice. And thank you to our listeners. That wraps up another episode of Don't Miss a Beat, and you can find us on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, and we'll see you again soon.